where we came from, where we've been. They're eternal questions that say a lot about where we're going as the human race. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air.
Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And sometimes with these shows, they're hard to categorize. Could be in the other side, could be in Ancient Mysteries. And the subject that we're going to talk about today really does extend back to ancient times. So I decided to pop it on the Ancient Mysteries feed. So I hope you'll indulge me, and I think that you will like this show. And today we are going to talk about something a little bit different. And I love this. I mean, sometimes when you talk about the supernatural, the paranormal, the metaphysical, there are a lot of things that are repetitious. But I love when we have something that is original in the sense that there's not 72 books out about it, that it's something bringing something that may not be new per se. Maybe it's been around for a long, long time, but it's being presented and reintroduced and maybe educating some of us about some of these topics. I'm talking about the new book from Mark Stavish. It is called Egregores, the Occult Entities That Watch Over Human Destiny. And we're so glad to have Mark with us. He's a respected authority on Western spiritual traditions. He's the author of 26 books published in 7 languages, including The Path of Alchemy and Kabbalah for Health and Wellness. He is founder and director of the Institute for Hermetic Studies and the Louis Claude de Saint Martin Fund. He has appeared on radio shows, TV, and in major print media including Coast to Coast AM, the History Channel, BBC, and The Gray Lady, The New York Times. He is also the author of the blog Vox Hermes, and he lives in Wyoming, Pennsylvania. Mark, welcome to the show today. Thank you for taking time.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, you've done 26 books. Why? And we were talking, there are a couple of different pronunciations out there, but I'll just go with the Egregores. Why did you decide to do a book on this topic?
Well, two reasons. One is, it's a topic that is well known to many people who have been dealing with classical Western occultism. And the other reason was because I was having lunch with a good friend of mine, Dr. Jocelyn Godwin, and I said to him, I'm thinking about writing a book on egregores. And he said, well, wonderful, because if you don't do it, I'll have to. So from that, the book came. It's really a topic that, you know, we had both talked about many times, and I talked about with other folks. But what we had noticed is that there was no book about it in existence. So as with all my writing, I try not to reinvent the wheel, but to write something that is really an original contribution. And with egregores, what we did is not only did what I believe to be, and most people believe is the first and only comprehensive book on the topic, but also brought to light for the average reader, someone who is not well known with about what goes on in many occult organizations, and even people who belong to them but don't know what's going on in them, what is one of the fundamental driving forces in that. And it's not just occult organizations, but as you see in the book, it's all social, religious, political, and even commercial organizations. What is their driving force? What is the hidden energies behind them?
So if you had to define this for someone who didn't know and maybe heard the term, but didn't know what an egregore was, how would you define it for them?
The easiest one, because there's two definitions, the easiest one is the collective unconscious forces of a group.
Okay.
Very simple. The second one, This is the classical one that goes back to the classical period. It's not only the unconscious entities or the unconscious forces of a group, but what are the spiritual forces and possible entities that are connected to and benefit from that group, as well as provide some kind of energy to the group.
And we've done programs on tulpas, thought forms, before. How does this differ or compare or contrast with the idea of a tulpa?
Well, everything is a thought form in many ways, but not all thought forms are egregores. So you and I can have an idea. The idea is, I'm going to go have lunch. That is a thought form that motivates me to action, but we wouldn't call it an egregore. We wouldn't even think of it as a magical creation, which is what the tulpa means. It means a magical act. So we wouldn't think of it that way. You have a desire to create a successful radio program. That's a thought form that takes on, in some ways, a life of its own, right? I mean, that's the desire, that the force will be so overwhelming that people want to participate. Okay, is that an egregore? Kind of, sort of, in the first sense of a collective unconscious force. But it doesn't necessarily have, as I said earlier, spiritual entities or beings attached to it. So it's kind of tricky. Everything is everything is a thought form, but not all thought forms are tulpas or should we say egregores.
Now, are egregores positive? Are they negative? Or are they neutral? In essence, you could create a positive egregore or a negative one, I'm assuming.
Yes. That's really the answer, is yes. All egregores are about is limitation. It's a construct. It's a construct designed to constrain you, to move you in a particular direction. It's no different than going to college and saying, you know, I'm going to be an engineer. Well, once you've decided on that course of engineering, that limits the classes you can take, because that's the direction you're heading in. Same thing if you're going to build a house. You have to have blueprints and you have to have a design, and there's certain limitations about what you can do, in order to have it get it done and be functional. So egregores are about limitation, just as a thought form is. It's about focused energy. The question is, what do you put into it and what do you get out of it? And that's where we talk about how do these affect on social human interaction, which is what we're mostly concerned with, as well as the spiritual aspect. But how does your involvement in this group begin to constrain you in positive ways or maybe negative ones?
Now, in the sense that you're talking about in this book, Egregores, what is an example can be worth 1,000 words, like a picture. So what's a good example of an egregore that maybe most of us would be familiar with?
Oh, pick the religion of your choice. Pick the place. As soon as people start saying, well, the joke is my great uncle was a very good mystic, used to say, you know, Moses saw God and said to you, who are you? And the answer came back, you know, I am that I am. Well, we always talk about the I am being the most powerful part, but what happens is people usually say I am and then fill in the blank, and that's where all the problems begin. And, you know, because whatever we identify with, we move towards and begin to model and become. That's the whole function of occult practices, psychotherapy, acting as if, hypnosis. All of that has to do with shaping our identification. Well, what advertisers do is they do the same thing. They do it subtly and through suggestion. They create a model that and grabs your and fascinates, and I use that word purposely, your imagination. And then you begin to identify with whatever images and sounds that are on the screen, whether it's to vote for a candidate, buy a car, or join some kind of religious organization or political movement.
So it's almost like metaphysical branding?
That's exactly what it is. Metaphysical branding. And not only is it branding, but it's a branding that puts its stamp on the individual, that says in the psychic realm, this person belongs to me.
Wow. Wow. Very, very interesting indeed. Now, in terms of these, what is the relationship between the individual and the egregore?
It really depends. It depends on where they are in the food chain. I mean, we have this notion of democracy and representative government, and that somehow that's all natural, but nature is a hierarchy. And all you have to do is get out there and realize, you know, where am I in the food chain? You know, the invisible domains are a hierarchy. It's not about anything other than power. You know, power and knowledge, they're the same thing in the invisible. We make that down here in the physical world, we're confused about those things, you know, but power and knowledge are what make the universe go round. They're the same thing. So in an esoteric and spiritual orders, and as we would say, even political, because they're closer to that, they're very, you know, political animals, as we refer to them, you know, it's about power. same with business. It's about power in terms of where are you on the profit sector? How big are you? How productive are you? How well-known are you? So if you come into this egregore, and we'll assume it's a spiritual one, it's coming in for your best, you want to improve yourself and the quality of your life and your self-understanding, you come in with a lot of altruism and a lot of devotion. So you don't question a lot of stuff that goes on. Now, as you move through it, you take on, say, some relationship of authority and power and helping out and all of that stuff and teaching others maybe. So you identify more and more slowly and unconsciously, but also consciously, with the organization really subsuming your life.
Now, this also reminds me of another thing. Let me ask you if this is kind of along that line. When I hear of things like the power of positive thinking or the secret, visualization, or even you look at things like the work that Neville Goddard did, do you feel that this plays into it, that you kind of create this creation of how you want your life to go and how you believe it's going to go? And if you put enough psychic energy behind it, that it can actually create it? Is that all kind of in the same wheelhouse there?
Very much so, except that those tend to be individual activities and therefore tend to be free of the kind of collective influences I'm talking about. Or freer, I should say. They tend to be freer because you're not identifying with the group's mission or the group activity. You know, where like someone says, you know, I am Evangelical Baptist, I am Hasidic Jew, you know, I am, you know, Tibetan Buddhist or convert, you know, or I am whatever, let's pick some other groups, you know, whatever Templar or Martinist or Rosicrucian group they may belong to. See, as soon as they fill those in, notice you can think of people automatically who say, I am this, and every aspect of their life is then conforms to those ideals of that group. To more or less to some degree. And again, that can be very good for them if it helps them bring order and peace and happiness to their life. However, it can also be very limiting for them if maybe they're not willing to go beyond those limits, or if maybe the group does not have their best interests at mind, at heart. Because just because you come to a group, whether it be political or religious or even business or nonprofit particularly, okay, they're big on altruism and they're not really coming through. You come there with the best interests, and your emotional energy, which is the fuel of every egregore, the fuel of every spiritual entity, you know, that gets abused. So you have to be very careful. That's why it's very good to work alone on your spiritual projects, but you have to know how to work.
By extension, would something like a movement fall into this category? Because I'm thinking, let's go back so we don't get into the political controversy of today. I try to stay away from that as much as possible. But let's say the Vietnam War anti-war movement, that was certainly, looking at it historically, seems like something that had its a life of its own, so to speak. So is something like that, where you've got many people focused on the same goals with maybe kind of the playing the same memes through their head, they have kind of a unified goal. Is that an example of an egregore?
Well, they all very much are so, because anytime you have that, as you said, the memes playing in their head, those are the mantras, those are the affirmations, those are the words of power, the prayers, whatever you want to call it, that give vitality and energy to the action. Again, it's the constant repetition of these sounds and words of identifiers that bring energy to it. And I say that very specifically. That's why logos and any type of slogans are so important, because they're a form of suggestion, whether hypnotic suggestion, you want to call it that, or any kind of suggestion that keep people focused. You know, we always say, pay attention to the voices in your head. You know, in therapy, it's about getting rid of the negative talk, identifying it and getting rid of it and replacing it with something positive. Well, that's for you as an individual. But when you're in a group, it's about the group slogan. You know, whether it's the Communist International or whether it's anti-war movement or whether it's, you know, the National Socialism, whatever it happens to be. They all have slogans and songs for a reason. Those are their mantras. Those are their prayers.
In the book, you have a chapter dedicated to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
and related egregores. And although I do apologize, I pronounced it about three different ways during the show.
That's all right. and you'll hear three different ways from me, depending on who I'm talking to.
Yeah. So nevertheless, we know what we're talking about. But talk about this. Maybe, again, I think most people who are listening to this may not be as steeped in this. Talk about what the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was and how it played into egregores.
Well, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was an organization started in 1888 in England. It was a magical order founded by a group of Freemasons who were very interested in magic. They were also interested in various ways in the Theosophical Society. They were coming on the heels of Madame Blavatsky. And they created an organization that really was quite significant for its period. It had some of the brightest minds in it. It was never terribly large at its height. Its historical height, but it had some bright minds in it, some wonderful creative people, and they were, of course, a little bit too big for their britches, and it blew up in a schism about 12 years later, around 1900. Well, when things blow up, you know, some sparks blow out, but others start new fires, and from this organization has come the majority of the information that the average reader will find on ritual magic to this day. So over 100 years later. So if you go to the store, go to Amazon, or go somewhere and you look up ritual magic, for the most part, or even Wicca, the modern witchcraft movement, or not witchcraft, Wicca movement, is deeply indebted to it. And you'll see all the methods of magic, or many of them, are found in the original teachings of the Golden Dawn. Now, where do egregores come in? Of course, magical orders like this often will tell you that they are connected to unknown superiors, the Mahatmas of Blavatsky, the great masters, the great white brotherhood, something of this nature that says we're not just a physical entity, we're not just a role-playing game or a research society, we actually have connection to spiritual, intelligent forces that are almost beyond human comprehension. And you see the phrase used a great deal by a lot of these British groups that even exist today, a fully contacted order. And that's what they're referring to. Contacted where? In the invisible. And that what they're referring to is their egregore and the spiritual entities that they say are behind it.
Now, you have another chapter here about pop culture and the creation of egregores. It's interesting you talk about things like UFOs, Feng Shui, and Slenderman. Of course, Slenderman, we're familiar with that horrible case where these kids assaulted this other child because of their belief in Slenderman, thought they were acting on behalf of Slenderman. But lo and behold, and we've done shows on this, people started reporting, seeing what they purported to be a real Slenderman. So, I mean, was, you know, from this internet creation, was something created? And do we see the same things with UFOs? And then this one was unexpected, Feng Shui. So I'm interested to your thought about that.
Well, that's the whole notion. I mean, of course, you're going to have people say, no, you know, thoughts don't, they don't have any effect other than on me or on people together. The thoughts are limited to the ends of our fingertips. But of course, the whole notion of parapsychic research is to suggest that maybe that isn't the case. And there's a lot of research that suggests telepathy is possible and that mind does have an effect on the physical world. Now, we also see that almost all of our spiritual traditions are based on that notion, too, that it's not just a self-suggestion. So whenever we deal with this concentration and idea, there is always the belief, at least among esotericism, that it actually comes to exist in the invisible. And that the more energy it's given, the more it's thought about, the more it's focused on, just like in The Secret, right? Just like in Neville Goddard, that it will come to manifest somehow, some way, tangibly in the physical world. Now, between a full incarnation, we'll call, that is a living, breathing Slender Man, or a UFO, there's going to be what I'll call a ghost version, that is something which we see but isn't quite tangible. Okay, it's like in a projection, if you will. We see it, we encounter it, but we don't know what to make of it. So it is very possible. I'm not saying it happened. I'm saying, but it is, according to this theory, very possible that all of that effort, of course, creates one of these things, just like a tulpa, as you talked about earlier, and it exists temporarily, and then eventually it decays. And as far as UFOs go, this is nothing new. Jean Dubuis, the French alchemist, used to talk about this off and on, but Jacques Vallée, French UFO researcher, in his book Messengers of Deception, which I encourage all of your listeners to read, was quite adamant that not only were UFOs not from outer space, they're from something else, somewhere else, but at the same time, that the amount of deception around it, even after decades, made it impossible to understand, and that they could not be understood. He was quite adamant in his diaries and his writings that the UFO phenomena could not be understood apart from parapsychology and the occult.
It's interesting because when you look at something like UFOs, boy, does there seem to be a trickster element to it.
Oh, it's one giant deception.
Yeah, that's...
And then you have to say, who benefits? That's always the question with any act, who benefits? And here we get into the notion of the multitude of egregors, just like human beings. These are living entities or groups or clans, you know, if you want to think of it in those terms. It's very simple. It's not complex. So, you know, you have groups that want to do their best to help bring people into a state of awareness and awakening in their own. You have people who want to make the world a better place through better sanitation and hygiene. You know, you have people who want to have better food and all these things. And then you have groups that want to take advantage of people or misguide them intentionally or, you know, keep them in ignorance.
Now, I know we're going to have more than one fan of H.P. Lovecraft out there. You talk about Lovecraft and egregores. Talk to us about that. I think that's fascinating, and he was certainly a very interesting person.
Well, I think I just like Lovecraft because he's a great segue into what is a very popular revival and has been going on for a while. He was not well known in his period. I mean, he wrote a great deal. He was very prolific, but he was very he essentially died in poverty. Okay, he wasn't well paid for it. So his fame in death, like many artists, is stronger decades after his death than it was during his time frame. But what makes him interesting is his writing was very much about these deep, dark recesses of the human mind and of life, and in many ways it's futility. But what he said is these were not so much creations as we think of fiction, but his actual dreams. And he was writing his dreams. Okay, so many people have come to theorize that these dreams were actually some kind of insight he was having or some kind of unconscious experience, and that he was writing them down. Now, he was an avowed materialist, so he would deny any the paranormal. But that's not even the point. It doesn't matter what he believed. It's a matter of what happened, what was actually going on with him. So many occultists have grabbed onto his writings and have used them to try and attempt to understand some of those darker recesses of not just the human mind, but then, of course, the cosmos as a whole. And Kenneth Grant was one of those. And Kenneth Grant was Aleister Crowley's second secretary. I believe Israel Guardi was his first, and I think he only had two. And Grant wrote some really terribly strange and fascinating books that explore the question of when does fiction become fact?
Interesting. It is interesting because my whole, and I've been doing these shows 13 years, and we cover everything from UFOs to ghosts, and I often get the feel that somebody's playing a big trick on us, and it's all more, we try to settle for very linear explanations that map to what we see in the physical world that may not be at all applicable. So sometimes you wonder if it's all just a big put on.
Well, the problem that I have found, and I've talked to many people about this, and we've trying to resolve it, but it's so difficult, is that, and it's gotten worse, not better, is that folks in the UFO community, folks in the parapsychic community, folks in the ghost community, we'll call that ghost hunters, they don't really talk to one another. They exist in echo chambers.
Right.
And I'll throw into that then, you know, they're all walking blind. I mean, they're well-intended, but they're walking blind. They don't have a map. And who they don't talk to is the occult community. They don't have, I found very few of them have any real solid understanding of classical occultism, you know, Western metaphysics, or Eastern occultism metaphysics. It's just tends not to be there. So from a esoteric perspective, if you want to look at the cosmos as made up of hierarchies, with the physical domain being the densest, okay, therefore the most ignorant, and then moving through kind of a shadowy, dreamy, unconscious, and then into some kind of intellectualization, and then, you know, greater and greater areas of openness and awareness, we'll call that light, for lack of a better term, greater clarity, greater light. Most of these groups are all just banging around in the shadowy realm. And they don't even, they kind of know that, but they don't know how to get out of it. So they set themselves up for deception again and again and again. And you have, as I said in the book, you know, the Narjuna said the gods are scoundrels. You know, and, you know, the one Tibetan statement was, when gods are desperate, they lie. And you're told in the Gospels all the time, you know, test the spirits. But people have such little actual encounter with the invisible and the beings there that they don't even know how to test them. They're just, you know, they just want to sit down with a Ouija board or something and wow, you know, we're talking to something or what have you. Or, hey, I saw a UFO. Well, yeah, it could have been a weather balloon for real. It doesn't necessarily mean it was a spaceship from outer space or those kinds of things. So that's many of the problems that we run into with them.
You talk about freeing yourself from these egregores. Is that something we should want to do? Does it depend on what the egregore is? Should we always try to free ourselves? And how do we go about that? I know that's a lot of things wrapped in one, but there you go.
It's simple. Look at all your relationships and say, is this good for me? Is this healthy for me? That's all. What do I put into it, and what do I get out of it? That's all you need to do. What am I putting into it? What am I getting out of it? Is it actually helping me, or is it hindering me? And we have to do that all the time in day-to-day relationships. I mean, especially when you're dealing with codependencies and addicted personalities. Because the egregore, if it's negative, is really just a form of codependency.
Interesting. Interesting.
So just look at it that way. And you should free yourself from as many of these influences as you can, because it's just, you know, they're just little vines sapping your energy and attention and strength, so they keep you from your goals. And you just narrow it down to what are my goals, and what are the relationships I have that are assisting me in achieving those goals? And then you free yourself from the rest. But it's hard because it's all emotional. You know, you often have, just like with addiction, you have to give up friends often, sometimes family. It's the same thing with these groups. Sometimes when you walk away from a religious or political or social movement or a cult organization or spiritual group, you're giving up friendships that may have been for decades.
Now, here's a question for you. How do you go about freeing yourself from it, though? What do you actually do?
Well, here's a test. If you are involved in a movement or a group or a religious activity or spiritual activity, take all of those things that are around your house or apartment right now that are associated with it, because you know how you start putting pictures on the wall. You know how this goes, right? And you build your altar, and it has all this stuff dedicated to your practice, okay? Take all of that. You know, all the music that's just from that style of activity, you know, it's Indian music or Tibetan music or Gregorian chant, whatever, religious music. Take all of it, put it in a box, and put it in your closet for a month. And then come back in a month and notice how you act over that month when those images and sounds are no longer influencing you.
That's really interesting. That is interesting, because I know sometimes if you get out of an environment that's unhealthy in some ways, you feel totally different and you have a brighter outlook and you just feel better about things, like a weight has been lifted. You go back into that environment and all that old baggage comes back on you. That would explain it.
Yeah. Well, you know, they call that in the recovery movement, people, places, and things, that you blame people and places and things for your problems. But at the same time, people, places, and things can benefit you and help you. You know, you become like the five people you're closest to. So if the five people you're closest to are just reciting the same stuff, whether it's good or not good, you have to say, okay, now have I moved beyond this? Or maybe, you know, I shouldn't be here and this isn't good for me. You know? So yeah, it's very simple. And then, you know, most people after a month or so of this realize, wow, this had a bigger influence on my day-to-day thoughts. I was really in an echo chamber here. I didn't think of anything else but, you know, whether it's my llama or my lodge work or my whatever it happened to be, PTA, you know, to figure it out. You know, and then you start to have more mental space.
Very interesting. Well, it is a fascinating topic, and I'm guessing that, as you said, this is really the singular book that's been written on this, and the goal here is to enlighten people, make them aware of these egregores, what they are, how they kind of latch on to you, and if you want to free yourself from them. And I'm assuming it's going to be kind of fun to share that enlightenment with people.
Well, it's really great. And, you know, when people finally hear what's going on, when they sense this, everyone senses it, but they don't really have a word to call it. And when you can finally name something, you can really begin to take control of it and dissect it, okay, or use it to your advantage, whichever you prefer. And, you know, in the back of the book, we have three examples of people who explain their horrific experiences with egregores in their groups. Now, of course, these are extreme. That needs to be understood, but that's why they're there, because they are extreme examples of something negative. And not everyone's going to have that, but it's good for people to know that this has occurred. And that way they can begin to say, yeah, I want my freedom. I'm going to be an adult in the universe. I'm going to be responsible for my choices, and I'm going to be responsible for my becoming.
Very interesting. The book is Egregores, the Occult Entities That Watch Over Human Destiny. Mark, where can people find more information on the book and everything you do?
They can find more information on the book, of course, at Amazon or, of course, any of their local booksellers, because it is through Inner Traditions or the Inner Traditions website. And, of course, they can feel free to go to hermeticinstitute.org. And, of course, it is the Institute for Hermetic Studies. Just Google that. HermeticInstitute.org is our website, or they can take my name, Mark Stavish, Google that, and find me on Facebook if they like, or Vox Hermes, Google that. They'll get our blog post, and all sorts of information is there. So they've got many ways to find me if they want to.
Mark, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this show. Mark had amazing insight and a very interesting area we've not explored on the programs. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And thank you for your support and being a Plus Club member. And we'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.